Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. I'm Matt Myra. Chris died.
What?
Oh, he's here.
I'm here from beyond the grave.
Ghost Chris.
I would hope that if I died that you would announce that better.
What? No, I think that was really a good way to do it.
You know why I'm okay?
Why are you okay?
Someone backed me up on iDrive. iDrive online backup protects all your digital devices, computers, laptops, smartphones, tablets, protect photos, documents, whatever you need. And your data is secured with 256-bit AES encryption.
256 bits?
So no one but you can access your data. iDrive is offering a special 75% off the first year for new users.
Hang on, 75%, Chris?
That's right, for the first year for new users. Using the promo code Nerdist, go to iDrive.com, that's the letter iDrive.com/Nerdist, to sign up. Start protecting your data for less than $15 for the first year. Matt Myra, how was your vacation?
Chris, I napped.
What is
golf.
A nyap?
A nyap.
Is that something you do with Nyan Cat?
Nyap.
So you're sleeping with a rainbow trail behind you?
It was just shooting out of me.
And your Pop-Tart cat.
Nyap, nyap, nyap. That's what I was doing the whole time.
Did you use a special nyap on your phone?
Yeah, you just download the nyap and it's real easy. It's free.
I found out that that people can take what I guess is called a vacation, where you actually don't do anything, which is nuts. It was amazing, but we're gonna talk. We should talk more about our vacations. We're gonna do another Hostful this week.
What? I don't believe you.
It's true.
Bullshit.
It's not an empty promise, Matt. I promise you.
I get a lot of those.
We're definitely gonna do more Hostful. What did you do?
When I was gone, let's see. We did the New York was fun.
Yeah.
We stayed there for a little while. And then went home for a bit, then went to Palm Springs.
Oh.
Had a good time over there. That's where I nyapped.
How did you nyap next to John Mayer's giant new mega truck?
It was hard to do because it was so loud.
Myat Myra ran into John Mayer's.
Yep, I saw John Mayer, and then I saw John Mayer,
the naturalist?
John Mayer.
The naturalist John Mayer would not buy a giant mega truck.
Well, maybe he would because he'd get closer to nature.
I guess.
Just check out, if you're listening to this still somehow, God bless you, first of all. Second of all, go to John Mayer's Instagram and look at his giant truck that was parked outside of our hotel, and then I didn't put it together until I saw John Mayer in the hotel, and then a couple days later, Dory was looking at John Mayer's Instagram. Sure enough, that was his truck.
So I'm sure, when you saw that, were you like, who the fuck would
like,
have such an
that?
Obnoxious piece
my,
of machinery?
No, my brain told me that it was obviously a former cattle rancher that had made it big.
or a drug lord who was like...
It seemed like just like a guy who took RVing to the next level.
You know what it was? It was a Beverly Hillbilly situation. Cattle rancher shoots at
oil.
The ground
bubbling
crude came up.
Black gold. Texas tea.
Texas tea. And so that's probably what you thought.
Yeah. Wow.
That was a cattle rancher.
This is like a mini Hostful.
You know what was fun is that, and we are going to be doing more Hostfuls.
Sure.
I'm scheduling them, Myra.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
You know what was really fun on the podcast today? It was Wayne Knight.
Nedry himself.
He was great.
He was quite a talker with a very interesting life situation of the whole private investigator thing.
Don't spoil it!
Oh God, guys. But yeah, it's actually pretty interesting, the whole thing. He was a good guy.
Wayne Knight is promoting The X's, which is Wednesday at 10:30 p.m. on TV Land.
Whoa.
So you should definitely...
watch that show. It's got all your favorites from previous sitcoms. Like Donald Faison.
And Nerdist Podcasts.
And Kristen Johnson. She's great.
Kristen Johnson,
has she been on our podcast?
No, she's not been on the podcast. She should be on the podcast.
She plays, in Austin Powers 2, she plays... I like to keep thinking of who she plays in things and can't remember the name. She has a fun cameo in Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
All right.
Let's go look at it.
Wayne Knight, Nerdist Podcast, number 620.
Oh, thank God for our sponsor for bringing this episode to everybody.
Well, our other sponsor is Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com. Make your post office your home.
2015, I'm only using the promo code Nerdist.
Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Nerdist at Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist Podcast, number 620.
Wait, you don't have to enter that. You don't have to enter Nerdist Podcast number 620.
No, I was just...
You sounded like you were telling them to enter that promo code. They won't get a discount if they do that.
That was called a tight segue.
You didn't... No, you made it just one thing. Guys,
Matt, you are not
going to
fight with me in front of company.
No.
I'm sorry, guys. Just give it a second. Matt, you just shut your mouth.
Chris, you're still dead. You're still dead.
Oh,
you're dead.
I'm
go back to the It's calling you. Go to the light. Not that light. That's my light.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Sinewy shape.
I try to stay as sinewy as possible.
Which makes it really bad when it's super cold outside. Because,
yes, and wet.
And wet, because I basically have the cold tolerance of a newborn chihuahua.
But luckily you're wearing a hat. So
I'm wearing a hat so I can protect myself. You know, we're just not... I know LA gets a lot of shit because any kind of weather... is the city basically just folds in on itself. Like, yes. the everything starts to implode. And if it rained like this for more than a week, there would be martial law. Like, we just don't really know how to process
it. Well, just wait till nuclear winter happens. It's going to be really for shit here.
Whoa. We were just trying to deal with rain. You know, but it, but
now I imagine driving a nuclear winter. Fuck, I don't know.
I shouldn't have looked directly at the explosion.
I quit. I just
can't
quit.
See anything.
But you know, we're just, it's just because we're not used to this kind of weather. I mean, this is basically like throwing a squirrel in a pond and being like, you know, and all the fish watching just point and laugh at it. We're the squirrel in the pond.
It's an interesting analogy, but one I won't use again.
You know, someday you're going to use that analogy.
Yes.
And then
the
I would
squirrel
like
in the pond analogy.
Go squirrel in the pond.
It would be when I win an Emmy, which will be never.
No, that's not true. You can totally win an Emmy. And when you do, and when you use a squirrel analogy, then I would like the apology.
All right, very well.
You were right. It's a fair analogy to employ. It's really nice to have you here on the podcast.
Well, thank you very
much.
We
were all big fans of yours. This is
what happened. When did it end?
No, it never ended. It ended when you refused to use the squirrel analogy.
Oh,
up to that
sorry.
Point.
Okay.
Up right. to that point. But Matt is probably. Did you have you slobbered on Wayne?
No, oh, not yet. I was easing into it. No. Just,
hey, it's raining. Go for it.
Well.
I won't even notice.
Well, I constantly watch Seinfeld and Jurassic Park. The first
loop.
Jurassic Park. Like
the Jurassic Park.
The Jurassic
yes,
Park.
None
yes. of this Lost Worlds or
I don't understand.
Threes.
People constantly are asking me, like, are you coming back? And I'm like,
did the Dilophosaurus just make out with you in the Jeep? What happened?
This sucker slobbered all over me while eating me to death. Do you understand? I'm not coming back.
We didn't actually see your body, though.
I said that, you know, numerous times. No one seemed to listen.
No one picked up.
And I thought, you know, big meal, small dinosaur, I come back as an amputee. Why not?
Why not?
You know, an eye patch and a thing. And
How about this? How about somehow when their frog DNA, when nature found a way, something got and you transformed into a hybrid human dinosaur creature.
Well, why don't we just make a movie out of the red herring that was the can of Barbasol? Yeah. What was the point in the can of Barbasol? There was none.
The Barbasol,
you know what I mean?
Which deliberately we show it fall and get covered
and
in mud.
And we see covered in mud and something's going
to
happen.
I'm going to tell you something. The Barbasol was another example of big shaving cream coming into film. And trying to product
placement. The other thing is, like, why don't we do, like, product placement on Ipana toothpaste? You know what I mean? Like, why Barbasol? I mean, why made you come up with Barbasol?
How about Choward's violet chewing gum?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Or Blackjack or something like that.
I wrote a thing at the Nerdist channel and I was over there writing YouTube videos for you. And I don't know if nothing ever happened with it, but we were going to have... have you the guy that gives you the Barbasol can, whose name I'm forgetting in the movie. What is his name? Yes.
Yes, and bad things happen to
yes.
him. Let's not
and,
talk about that.
And what I was going to have was when you were saying, Dotson's here. We got Dotson. I was going to have a cut to somebody who goes, take the shot. And just get a squib blows up and you just finish the pie and go.
I'm sad that never got made.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there that never got made.
What's interesting to me is like the people who died in Jurassic Park died for cause.
Yes.
Like, you know, like this guy is grotesquely fat. Kill him. This man is black. We can't kill him, but he smokes. Okay, so we get rid of him. This guy's a lawyer. Good enough.
People cheered in the theater when the lawyer got eaten. Yeah, yeah. People cheered.
That was way better than my pitch of Wayne Knight Rider, where
I'd watch that all day.
Wayne Knight, basically, you as yourself, basically get Kit the car, and you basically just take him around on errands all day. I really don't think we need to stop at the container store again, Wayne. I know, but I'm trying to organize.
Basically, I need a new furnace. We got to go to Home Depot.
Yeah. Please. I hate the parking lot there. It's always full of people.
Please don't eat in the car, Wayne. You know what I'm saying? Oh, come on.
What's your background? Where did you start? Did you start in comedy? Like, were you a live performer?
No. Sort of. I started out as an actor. I went from college to a regional theater, got an Equity card, and went to New York. By 23, I was on Broadway.
Oh my God!
And I did that play for 3 years, and then I was unemployed. You know, because I was a fat character actor, and I thought, the world is my oyster. And then, you know, the play ended, and there was like crickets. There was nothing. I didn't have an agent when I got in the play. I didn't have any representation. I went and saw this play, and I said, you know, I could play that part. I made up a resume. I handed it to the stage manager. I walked down the alley to the guy. 3 months later, they called me in to audition. I got the part.
Wow. No, when you made it, did you just write it in pencil?
Pretty much. I at the bottom of my first resume was unafraid to consume new products. You know, I had absolutely no skills. Do you ride a horse? Perhaps.
Perfect for Broadway. Perfect for Broadway.
Yes.
Those horse operas on Broadway.
But I mean, the character was a 16-year-old guy who had pimples and glasses. And I actually, at that time, had to wear a fat suit in order to play the part. Tells you, times have changed. In any case, went from there, and I did sketch comedy and did some comedy group stuff.
Yeah.
I used to go down to the Improv and catch a rising star and sit down front, laugh heartily, and have – and they say, are you a comic? And I go, no. I just didn't have the balls. You know, I mean, the thought of being out on the road and getting my slot at, you know, 2 in the morning for people from Kansas, I didn't have enough drive to make it happen. So I did group stuff. And always envied stand-ups, you know, for their tenacity and mental illness.
and the desperate need for attention.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, there was something about it, and I still feel, you know, it's just like I had done the Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee version of that commercial on the Super Bowl. That's as close as I'm going to get to being on that show. Because, you know, Jerry has a respect for comedians and people who go through the life, and
right.
And I think there's a difference being a comic actor than, you know, facing in front of angry people.
When you were going to catch an improv, what year was that, and who were you seeing?
Let's see. I mean, Joe Piscopo was a host.
Oh my God.
Gilbert Gottfried was getting up and being thrown out. They were constantly throwing him. I've got another. They're like, get him out, get him out. There's a guy, Gary Mule Deer.
Yeah, of course.
I'm trying to think of Bob Shaw. I mean, I'm just trying to think of the people who were in that time. You know, Belzer.
Mm-hmm. 78, 79?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
That's the beginning. That was the sort of – that was really when the New York – I mean, there was a thriving New York comedy scene in the 60s, but the comedy boom, like the bubble – late 70s, you know, people are spending money. They're going out. Like, stand-up is a thing.
Yeah.
What a great time to be in New York.
Yeah, and it was, like, really, you know, an exciting kind of thing. You know, I'd always been hanging around the carny, you know? It's like never really had the balls to be a clown, but I enjoyed big shoes, you know? Because literally, when I was a child, my first job in show business was as a shill for a carnival.
Really?
I grew up in a small town in Georgia, and at the base of the hill where my house was, it was a vacant lot where they put up the James H. Drew Exposition, which is one of these traveling carnivals. And I would ride my bike down there and just sneak in every day, you know. And the guy says, hey, kid, you want to help me out here? And I'm like, sure, you know. It's like
that was before Don't Talk to Strangers.
Right. It was like, you know, you throw with the baseballs and knock over four dolls. Yes. And it was the Beatles was here, B-E-E-T-L-E-S. And there right. were four mop-top dolls. And the guy had a springboard behind it that wouldn't allow you to knock down the fourth one. And when I would come by, he'd step on the thing that would release the barrier, and I'd throw it and knock the thing down, and they'd ring a bell, and they'd give me the teddy bear, and I would walk around back and give it to his wife, Rosa, in the trailer in the back. I never won the teddy bear. Oh, I just would, you know, shill for them, like, eight times a day, you know, like, here's another fine winner here at Tony's, you know?
Oh, if that kid did it, I guess I could do it.
Yeah. And I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do. Shill. So I went into network television.
Yes, which is exactly yes. And then at the end of every taping, you take the teddy bear back into the office.
Yes, that's
there
right.
You go. That's
right. Very similar.
Wayne, we need the teddy bear back.
No,
no, I'm just going to my dressing room.
Come on.
Nope, we need the teddy bear.
God damn it. What were they paying you, or was it just free admission to the...
What? Did I need to be paid? It was the proximity to the wonderment that was the carnival. I remember, like, all of the things... There was a thing called the glass house, which is like a mirror, like a trailer with mirrors in it, you right. know?
The glass house. We show you the way in, you find the way out. We show you the way in, you find the way out. Ma, bring Pa. Pa, bring the kids to the old glass house.
So I'm hanging around there, and then they have this other thing that says, Killer Rats from Paris. Killer Rats from Paris, living in the bilious sewers of Paris. They're armored for their protection from the horrors of the sewers of Paris. Killer Rats from Paris. You get there, there's an armadillo in a cage.
And, which, by the way, is also kind of exotic. Like the
yeah, but in Georgia, nobody's seen an armadillo. So to them, look at that damn killer rat, you know?
Armored for their
them
protection.
Rats got armor in France.
Wow.
That's incredible. I mean, is there... There are a few better branding operations than a carnival. To basically just take a room with some mirrors in it and a fucking armadillo they probably found in Texas.
Yeah, and they turned it into, you know, like magic. It's magic. All you need is somebody talking about it and getting a couple of rubes to walk in just once.
Well, that I think that is a pretty valuable thing to learn as a young performer wannabe, because you're basically learning that the importance, the way to connect with people is just through a story. And it doesn't matter what the product is right. as long as the story around it is good.
Yeah, and let them feel like they're discovering something that they haven't discovered before.
And what made you not run away with the circus?
Well, you know what? The people in the carnival would use the municipal local pool as a big bathtub.
Oh.
And they were somewhat less than savory.
Sure.
So I was around them for a while. I'm going, you know, I once rode in a cab with a guy who smelled like this. I don't want to, nah, you know.
Your parents was, like, Wayne, your new friends just shit in the living room.
Yeah, and I was young and pretty much scared of everything. So sure. I don't think that was going to happen for me. But I did eventually run away to New York, you know, with my friends and work as a waiter and audition for terrible things. And then I got a job as a private investigator, which was the other side of
it. Wait, hang on a second. You got a job as an actual private investigator?
I worked as a PI in New York for 5 years.
Wow.
You know, as a survival job. Because I'd been on Broadway, and then I crapped out. And I'm like, Jesus, I'm not going to go back to waiting tables. And I had a friend who said, you know, I can get you a job at this PI agency. I said, you're not a cop. You're not in criminology. You don't have any background. Goes, that's right. I said, well, why would they hire you? And more importantly, why would they hire me? And he says, well, they like actors because actors aren't upwardly mobile. They're usually conversant. They are more than willing to misrepresent themselves, and they have no scruples. I said, that's true. So
I had no idea of this actor-PI connection.
So what was that like for you? Like,
well, I mean, a lot of phone work. I did background checks on people. I did background checks on people in venture capitalists, nuclear plants. I followed people into Red Hook, Brooklyn, You know, I did a couple of surveillance things and marital things and stuff like that. But at the time, I had a very high opinion of myself. I had done a Butcher's Blend dog food commercial. I said, they're going to recognize me.
I got to just be a voice.
I can't follow these people. They'll turn around and say, aren't you the Butcher's Blend guy? You know?
Say, why is my dog barking at you?
Like, recognize you from something.
That's the perfect cover. You could go, yes, I am the Butcher's Blend guy. Thanks for
I wouldn't be following you.
Following
of course.
Now when I have all the dog food I can eat.
I have this teddy bear I need to return.
I'm a millionaire. Oh, no, from the commercial. I'm a thousandaire.
Yes, I'm a hundredaire.
I don't need this. Just sign here and pose for this picture.
I'm fascinated by this.
Please.
How would you do a background check before computers?
You know, it is unbelievable because we had a room full of phone books.
If that's what the Google server is?
It is.
Four guys in a room full.
A room like this with phone books to the ceiling, and you're like, do you have a Biloxi? I need a Biloxi. No, not an 81. I need an 82. You know, you're like, and then you make these calls. There was nothing called Coles Directory. You call Coles Directory and you'd say, you know, I need a reverse on this phone number, and they give you an address, and then you get the nearbys to two people on either side of that, and then you call one of those people and say that you were the cousin to one of the people in that apartment or house, and you've been locked out. They were supposed to leave the key under the mat, and they didn't. And do you know where they work? Do you know where they are? Then you call their work, and then you call their supervisor, and you check their employment. You say, well, how are they as a worker? You know, I always wondered, you know, how Uncle Fred is. And I did one on this guy who was trying to get a job at a nuclear plant as a startup engineer. And, you know, one of his references said, well, you know about the hospital thing, but it really wasn't that bad. And I'm like, hospital thing? So the next reference, I said, look, we know about the hospital. You might as well tell me more about it because it's just going to stop him from having this job. And he goes, well, you know, I mean, depression can happen to anyone. You know, go, yes, that's true. And then the third one, I said, well, I know he was in for depression, but how badly? And
oh,
I said, well,
wow.
They go, well, the shock treatments only lasted for, you know, and you go, well, you're not going to be working at my nuclear plant, I don't think, pal. Maybe, maybe not. So then I called the nuclear plant, and I told them, look, we found out that the guy was having shock treatments just last year or whatever. And they were like, thank you for saving me from, you know, hiring this guy. And I thought, well, I'm a killer. I've killed this man. That's fantastic.
Well, he's going to go back and get more shock treatments.
And then, of course, I got a call from the guy. And he's like, who are you, headhunters? Thank God you're calling because, you know, I haven't worked in a year. And I thought my family was just going to leave me. And I'm like.
Last known job, lightning rod.
Yeah, you know, so I was like, that's not so good.
Kind of not feel good. But what a great improv game you're playing.
I know.
You're basically
transformation of career.
Yeah. but real time improvised dialogue with people.
Totally improvised. And
where there are stakes.
Well, look, I was talking to admirals, and I'm talking to, like, you know, practically heads of state, and I would say things like, well, as you know, I mean, an atomic collider is never going to be able to control the heat problem. And he would say, well, yes, that's true. And then he would go on and, you know, so you learn how to improv some kind of segue that sounds like you've had some education.
So is that the best way to get people to talk?
Yeah, pretty much flatter. And then leave a gap.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're very good at telling these stories, so.
Yeah, well.
Guys, stop with the gap.
I just gave you a gap and you didn't fill it.
Yeah, I've learned. Never mind the gap. I've been.
Mind the gap. Mind the gap. It's perfect. The Wayne Knight story for private investigating.
Have you not written about this before or anything? It's really fascinating.
One of the things, I mean, I kept trying to pitch a show about it. And what, ironically, people, no, we don't like PIs. Like, what? You have like 1,000 shows about doctors and PIs. That's over. We're not doing that anymore. And the idea was the guy who trains the actors to be, you know, PIs.
Yeah.
Because the guy who trained me was like a kind of a strange man whose brain had boiled. He had whatever that, in some form of encephalitis.
Oh, okay.
Where his brain reached a temperature where it ceases to be a brain usually, but right. for him it kept going.
Oh.
And he would say things like, he'd look at you and go, "Hot dang, y'all. That's cowboy talk."
What the hell are you talking about,
no.
I don't know what you're no. talking about. And he goes, like, "Keep your $10,000. I want my bicycle."
Oh, oh. No, this was basically his brain was just an ash pile. It's, yes, just yes. a few little things firing.
And he was the one training me how to be a PI. This is why I went back to acting.
Wow.
But it so far the pattern is you basically, that's twice that you've shilled.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it just continued.
Yes. You know, it's and then I, you know, went into commercial chilling, and you know, it's just the same kind of, this is really good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's the same.
It's an acceptable. Do you think acting is an acceptable form of lying?
It's barely acceptable. I still think that actors are considered, you know, people who we really don't like but worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is strange that. We do worship them, but also like to look down on them at the same time.
We're waiting for them to slip on the banana peel so we can kill them.
Yeah. Well, because maybe it's that sort
That's why TMZ is so big. It's like, look, let's kill one.
Yeah. I mean, it is like a weird game hunting kind of a thing. I wonder if that's because maybe there's something about like, well, if you destroy your idol, you absorb their essence and their power. Like maybe there's some sort of
I think we secretly want them to be no better or different than we are, but we want fame.
Sure.
I mean, what it's come down to is that is the currency of the United States. It's not money anymore. It's momentary fame.
I wonder what people think happens when that comes along. I mean, like, what
you become a Kardashian and you get terribly wealthy for no apparent reason and have a larger butt.
Just those two things.
Just those two things.
I just want wealth and
butt. I had a bigger butt. I had like a bigger butt and some money.
Yeah, that's all. That's I guess. Well, I mean, you know, there must be. Obviously, there's a biological need for us to ascend the ranks of our immediate community. I guess there must be a biological reason for status. You know,
sure. I mean, the biological reason for status is that I can screw the attractive
more pussy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the entire idea for me when I started out. I remember I had auditioned. You know, I was in a speech class in high school, and the guy said, "You ought to audition for the local theater. The drama tours are doing a production of Send Me No Flowers, and there's a role of a cleaning boy." You know, I'm like. Okay. So I went to audition for that thing, and I noticed that there were all these people sitting on each other's laps, women sitting on men's laps, men that they were not married to.
Sure.
And they were married. Ah. And I thought, I like this. I like this a lot. You know, that. And in rehearsing at the Atco Playhouse where this was going on, there was this girl from a rival school who I was helping get a prop down from some shelf. She turned and we wound up kissing. And I was like, first time. And I said, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
I can get laid doing this. And maybe this is the only thing I can get laid doing.
I think you can fuck a lot of circus people, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, maybe.
You could have done that.
Yeah, but, you know, bearded people. And I would, no offense.
Oh, no,
I
I'm
mean,
not taking it.
You know, I mean, I don't have any problem with the fact that you have a beard. But luckily you also have a penis, I would assume.
Oh, thank God. Anyway. It's still there.
Yeah. We've never seen it, though. So I can't prove its existence. No.
We haven't?
No. Oh. No. No, Pixar didn't happen. Dick Pixar didn't happen, Matt.
Dick Pixar,
but I guess when you're young, and what was your dynamic like in school?
Was I a good student or anything? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, were you a good student?
Were you a popular boy?
Well, I was popular, but for no apparent reason.
Fame.
Well, you know, because I was you know, a fat kid and. And smart, and I'd skipped a grade, so I was a young fat kid. But I was snide and would make jokes at teachers' expenses and get thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
And
plus, you're the only guy in the county that can knock down all four bottles.
That's right. That's right. And I would join any club. and try to become the president of that club. For no apparent reason. I became,
kind of the opposite of the Groucho Marx theory.
I became president of the Mechanical Drawing Club, and I didn't know anything about mechanical drawing. I've never even mechanically drawn. But why not? Why not me?
And so once you became the president of the Mechanical Drawing Club, did you have any responsibilities? Or you were like, I got what I wanted. Fuck off, you guys.
Well, there aren't a lot of responsibilities for the president of that club. You know, it's like, make sure the pencils are sharp. What do you do? I mean, there's not a lot to do. You know, it's like don't hurt anyone with the protractor. I don't know. You know what I mean?
I like that this is sort of like, I like this empty overachiever thing where it's like, I want to get all these titles.
But what I had was in the yearbook, just photo after photo of like, President Wayne Knight, President Wayne Knight, President Wayne Knight. I was president of a club called the Mystic Knights. They renovated a Jeep.
That
I
was
knew
it.
Nothing. Yeah, I knew nothing about it. I did that. I was president of the math club, one of the worst math students imaginable, because nobody wanted it. I would like go to the clubs that people didn't want. You know, you got a doily club? I'm in. You know, I was like, I don't care. I don't care what it is. Elect me.
And did this, so this sort of elevated your status in school then.
And then when the acting started, people said, you know, because one of the good things about being a young fat kid is you look about 30 years older than you are.
Preach, so, brother, preach.
So put a little white in your hair and like, shit, you're middle-aged.
Then you can buy beer for people.
Yeah, I was 15, you know, like I'm middle-aged, am I? But playing middle-aged characters in plays and stuff like this, shit, you're believable.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you get to New York and you're working as a waiter, and then you audition for this play, and you're in this play for 3 years.
Yeah.
Do you have an agent at this time, or do you?
I went to an agent and I said, "Look, you know, I just landed this Broadway show, and I'd like for you to negotiate it." And he goes, "What show is it?" I said, "Gemini." I said, "I've seen it." "Well, you haven't seen it with me," because I'm not going again.
Oh.
I said, "What do you mean you're not going again?" He says, "If you're in another show, you know, give me a call." I said, "If I get in another Broadway show, what am I going to get in another Broadway show? Lightning has struck. Now is the time. Buy my stock now. I'm going up." You know, nothing. So I wound up with an agency that handled children, dogs, and athletes. That literally... And they couldn't decide, you know, like, what category should we put him in? You know, he's kind of a frisky puppy kind of thing. Can you do anything athletic? No. You're young, you know. It's like, so there was nothing. That's why I was in the play for 3 years. I couldn't leave. There was no place I could go.
That's why you need to start doing background checks on people when guy's like, "I'm not coming to see your play." Really? What do you think your wife would like to know about this girl that you've been seeing uptown?
It was so depressing that. But I there was a guy in the... in the play with me who had an agent, and Kathleen Turner was in the play at the time. She had come off the doctors, and this was before Body Heat. And
okay.
She was on her way to do Body Heat. And she had an agent who was also going to be later her boyfriend. And I chased after him, and he was my first big time agent.
Kathleen Turner's manager, agent boyfriend.
Yeah.
How was Kathleen Turner in the to work with?
Darling. She was wonderful.
Was she mildly British back then?
She's always been mildly British, but from Missouri, I think. You know, she. What's interesting is, you know, you meet people who believe in themselves to a degree that something good is going to happen to them, and you either envy or dislike them for their confidence,
mm-hmm.
But it works.
Yeah, I think that, because I think a lot of people worry, like, "Oh, I don't want people to think that I'm full of myself or think that I'm," but then other people are like, "Man, I don't really give a shit what other people think. This is what I'm going to do." Like that,
yeah,
that
and they,
pure
and then,
focus.
And they do it. You know, because they don't think there's anything wrong with the idea of them leading a film or them, you know, going off and doing, you know, climbing a mountain. And so they do. And you go, what made you think you could do that? You know?
Did you have that kind of confidence?
Shit, no.
No?
No. Mm-hmm. I did in terms of, I guess I did. Because, I mean, walking into that audition and whatever, I felt like, this is mine. You know, I'm going to take this. and I had unreasonable confidence about certain things, but I wouldn't say go to audition for Juilliard or something like that because I was afraid that they would laugh me out and throw me out.
Mm-hmm.
But I would audition for a part that somebody from Juilliard was also auditioning for.
Sure.
Thinking I could beat them for that part.
Right.
But I would not be accepted by anybody real.
You must be a good auditioner then.
Not for years. I'm a good auditioner, but usually I get another part than the one I'm auditioning for.
Hmm.
Really?
I recently went in and auditioned for the Coen brothers, and they're like, this is you. You know, and it turned out being a different part. And I don't know why, but I think...
How do you prepare to audition for the Coen brothers? Now, I know you've been working for a very long time, but that is like auditioning for Juilliard.
Yeah. No, there is a certain thing about that. But I mean, I've had these auditions for people in the past that I like Oliver Stone and people, you know.
Sure.
And I went in to audition for Oliver Stone and excuse me. Thank you. Coughing always good on the air. Here, let me push the button.
No,
we don't have a button.
You're just touching the desk with your finger.
I know.
Yeah, there's no.
But I went in, and it was Risa Brayman and Billy Hopkins were the casting directors, and they pulled me aside and they said, don't do anything actory. Nothing actory. Oliver hates actory. Don't be actory. I'm like, what did they think I was going to do? You know, how do you do? You know, it's like, what the hell was I going to do? I never understood that.
Oliver, you look marvelous. Yes.
Before I begin, I'm going to do some breathing exercises and movement.
You know, so usually my philosophy on auditioning is get in, do it, and leave as quickly as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Try not to say goodbye. Say, oh, I left something outside, and then don't come back.
Is that a leave them wanting more kind of a thing?
No, just leave them.
Just leave them.
Yeah. Because if it worked, it worked. And if it didn't, there's nothing you're going to do that's going to make it better. But I just want, and I really, I think you're, it's been a wonderful.
Because they're busy and yeah, they're just trying to move on.
Yeah, and they want you to leave.
When did you really start working? When did you start to feel the momentum happen?
I had a moment which was a kind of, there were two catalysts. One is I had gone off and done a sketch comedy show in England with Emma Thompson and William Sadler.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know William Sadler.
Who you wouldn't think of as a comedy beast, but he was funny.
Played Death in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and he was really great at it.
He was really funny at it, but usually he plays guys who are stripping the skin off somebody.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I had gone off and done that and then come back, and nothing was happening, and, you know... made friends with Emma, and Emma later was going to be doing Dead Again mm-hmm. with her then husband Ken Branagh, and said,
right.
"There's a part in this for you. Would you want to do it?" And I'm like, "Yes." And then by going out to LA to shoot that, and he was hot at the time. If a director says yes to you, then other people are willing to see you. And then suddenly, I started having auditions with other big directors because I was in a film that a big director was doing.
Right.
And then you book one or two of those, and next thing you know, there is a little bit of a role going. And as long as you keep that role going, you're fine. And if you don't, it just was an anomaly. And, so it's half and half for me. But the other big moment was I'm walking across the street in New York. I had done Ishtar, one of the world's worst films, as it's proclaimed to be. And also Dirty Dancing. And both of those had Jack Weston in them. And I'd spent time with Jack. And Jack, I don't know if anybody remembers Jack Weston, but he was like that. And he was like, oh, kid, you're great. Pass the drink. So I'm walking across Fifth Avenue, and I bump into Jack. And goes, Wayne, hell, how are you? What are you doing? Listen, I'm in this play, and I got to go off and do this movie, and I got to leave the play. But why don't I get you an audition for it? And he was at Lincoln Center doing Measure for Measure, Shakespeare. And I'm like, okay. And I went and auditioned for that and got it and replaced him in that. And that led the casting people for that were the casting people for Oliver Stone. And so I had auditioned through them for Oliver Stone, got the Oliver Stone movie, which then leads to Paul Verhoeven and Basic Instinct, which then Spielberg sees me in Basic Instinct and casts me in Jurassic.
Wow.
And this all comes from crossing the street.
That's incredible. But it technically does come from crossing the street. But
I mean, you got to deliver in a lot of jazz.
Of course. Well, but that's a lot of jazz. I mean, like my feeling is that if you were that consistent, there was going to be some other weird break. You know, like anyone can.
It also helps to be, you know, gigantically fat and someone who might die at any moment. You know what I mean? People go, look, he's going to blow. Cast him.
I don't think anyone says that.
Well, I don't know.
The insurance adjuster sure doesn't.
Well, that's true. When I was in England, you know, trying to get insured for the series, there was a the doctor was a humpback or hunchback, depending on how you look at it, who smoked cigarettes through a holder. And so, because it looked like there was a chimney above his head, because the holder would.
You do realize you're describing the penguin.
Yeah.
You should cut down on your triglycerides.
So he said, perhaps you would care for a smoke. It might relax you.
Ooh.
And I'm like, no, I don't think so. So he had me lay down on a table and put my hands in warm water. And I thought, and he says, is this to lower my blood pressure? No, I'm going to make you pee. No. He was trying to bring my blood pressure down. And he did it. You know, somehow he got my blood pressure just low enough that they could cast me.
Wow. Oh, so he was like.
That Cobblepot's a genius.
Dr. Cobblepot. That's, well, and, but it's. And that doesn't – did that make you go like, oh, maybe – I don't know. Does that – are you comfortable with that? Were you comfortable with that process?
Well, you mean as opposed to what? Like maybe I should lose 50 pounds by tomorrow or put my hands in hot water. I think I'll put my hands in the hot water and take the gig. Thank you very much.
And which gig was that?
No, this was a sketch comedy series which was called Assaulted Nuts.
Oh, that sounds really familiar.
I don't think it does.
No, I mean, as a person who was obsessed with comedy.
Right. It was myself, a guy named Daniel Peacock. There were three Brits, three Americans. And it was one of the first shows on Cinemax over here and one of the first shows on Channel 4 in Britain. Channel 4 just started. Mm-hmm. And so we were like cutting new ground, you know. Mixing British humor and American humor, and we sank somewhere in the ocean. Because truthfully, they don't blend,
right?
You know, in a real way.
Right.
I mean, one is wordplay and silliness, and rather intelligent, and the other is more kind of down and dirty. I mean,
right.
And they didn't quite marry. But it was an interesting time. I mean, I got to go off to England and do a sketch comedy show that nobody knew I was doing.
We really do not speak the same comedy language.
Uh-uh.
I mean, there are bits.
Otherwise,
of
Billy Connolly would not be able to walk the streets in America, and nobody bothers him at all.
Right, right, yeah. Right. I mean, there's
a god in the rest of the English speaking world.
Well, those big head of the class fans, they still. I hated that Howard Essman. Thanks for coming in.
This jumping to all these amazing. Directors, are you processing it as it's happening? Like, oh, this is different.
Well, interestingly enough, it stopped happening just as soon as Seinfeld began.
Really?
Well, I think that once you become iconic, it's rather hard to disappear into a film in the same fashion that you would. You know,
so they'd want to cast Newman.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be. You know, I'm a character actor, so you want me to be that guy, whoever you. You know, the guy who, mm-hmm. as opposed to there's Newman doing that guy.
Right.
Oh, right.
You know, so that it's different if you're headlining something than I think than if you're fleshing out the people around the lead. You know, you need to be more real.
How many episodes of Seinfeld is Newman in? It feels like a shit ton. But
there
I
were
bet
a lot
I'm
of them,
thinking
but I
it's
don't know.
More than it actually is because the character is so
people mention them and stuff. But I mean, I think that that's like you think there are more jalapenos in that
right.
in that chili than there
yeah.
are.
Yeah,
there's just one, but you know, it's well, still
it's a
hot.
Very powerful chili. Do you have an answer, Katie? Yeah. Katie, look it up. How many episodes?
Who was the most?
Make sure he's getting the right residuals.
Who was the most intriguing director that you worked with?
I think Gus Van Sant. Just because he didn't say a lot, but he kind of intuited what he needed to say to get out of you what he wanted, and it was a very comfortable experience. I was afraid of most people I worked with because I'm afraid of you right now because you were holding that red mic.
I am holding a red mic.
Might harm me.
He's also wearing shorts and a cabbie hat.
But now Oliver, you know, Stone, I feared him and with good reason. Spielberg was very nice to me, but, you know, at the same time, you realize that you're dealing with Patton and there's an army standing behind him and he goes, let's move over there. And the whole
right.
army moves there, you know? I mean, it's so it's a big deal. Verhoeven was very strange. And I went in to audition for him and he had a video camera up. When I opened the door, he's like got the camera on me.
Oh.
On hello. And so, you know, it's like, oh, we're doing porn. And I eventually will take clothes off, and I don't know why.
I'm just doing it.
Somebody's going to make me take my clothes off.
Just do
it. And in some ways, he did. I mean, he says that. Now, imagine you're looking at her. You're looking. I was like, yeah, I'm looking. And he goes, maybe you'll give a lick with your tongue. Maybe a lick. Just like a lick. Do a lick. Give a lick. So I give the lick, and he goes, yeah. Maybe two licks. Maybe lick. Maybe go like lick, two licks. I go, lick, yeah. Maybe three licks. Maybe lick. And I do lick. And he goes, no, too many licks.
I'm just going to take my penis out and let's see what happens.
Now I ask you, let's watch this VHS of RoboCop.
I mean, when you're making Jurassic Park, which, by the way, completely holds up 100%.
Yeah.
100%. The effect, like, the movie completely holds up.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I mean, really
when
is.
You consider the fact that, and ironically, the guy who shot me in the face with dyed black KY jelly through an air rifle lives across the street from me.
Oh, yeah? Really?
Got a nicer house than I do, that guy. Drives me crazy. I see him every Christmas and Halloween. We're out decorating the guy. Hi, how are you? but I remember that there were the velociraptors were kind of like in a sitting down below where we're doing the control room, and they're like waiting to be used puppets because this is Stan Winston and the puppetry thing. And the thing that got me the Dilophosaurus is a puppet. And they built a false floor, and there are people underneath, operators, operating its head, its mouth, and everything. And all of that holds up. It's not CGI. You know, I mean, it's old-fashioned, down and dirty, and it looks like you're acting with somebody.
Yeah.
Because it has – he was very, very clever about the nuances of movement. Like when it would look at me and be confused or curious and tilting his head and looking one eye and all that kind of stuff. And that's all like great puppetry.
But the CG in the movie still holds up too, which is pretty remarkable considering that. I mean, I think that's it's one of the reasons why I have such a low tolerance for bad CG. It's like, first of all.
Yeah.
You know, in the early 90s. Yeah, in 92 they did it. And now you can basically do that on your phone, you know? Like,
well, I remember when Video Toaster came in.
The Video Toaster, yes.
You know, and you're seeing sci-fi shows that were done in an afternoon. You know, I mean, they're doing, like, not Battlestar, but, I mean, I'm trying to think what shows before that were done Video Toaster. The,
Well, there's, like, Babylon 5.
Yeah, I think Babylon 5 was a video.
That was Video Toaster?
Yeah.
Very shitty starships.
Well, because you could see the wireframe underneath the shapes. You know,
I never liked it. And then then you go back to like Star Trek. I'm like, why that worked? Because ILM did the effects in the first season. They built those models. They're physical existing models.
Well, so now what about the trailer? What's your thought on the trailer?
I actually just watched in the writer's room here over at midnight, we just watched a side-by-side of the Jurassic World trailer and Jurassic Park.
Right.
And they found, they just put together shots. Every shot from Jurassic World is a shot in Jurassic Park.
Sure.
It's amazing. Like,
why
just
not steal from the best?
Yeah.
From yourself.
So for some reason that got me more excited to see Jurassic World. I was like, oh, okay, I can enjoy that. But I can't. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I was thinking about the trailer for Star Wars. Is the other world's
That trailer. The thing with that trailer was the fan made videos now are so good, like these fan Star Wars movies that like watching.
I personally prefer Lego.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Of course. But watching the Star Wars trailer, it just the whole time for me felt like some kid did this at home on Final Cut and Avid. Like that's what it felt like watching because the effects are so. Effects at home now are so good.
Wow.
That these kids are like doing this stuff online, and then like when you watch this, I was like, well,
oh, anyone can do that now. Yeah. It's been that on YouTube.
You know what anyone can't do? Put Harrison Ford on the screen. Show me that.
No, it was just a teaser.
I know.
I'm telling you, it was just a teaser. They can't blow the Han Solo load now. Like, there's a year before the movie comes out. They have to seed the Han Solo.
J.J. Abrams can cast. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, I'm actually
he did a great job with Star Trek.
I'm actually very much looking forward to it. I mean, I want to like things. I don't want to not like them, and I don't go into things when like this is probably gonna suck. Like, hey, because what if it doesn't? What if it's great? But you know, the conversation I had with a friend of mine last night, who's an insane Star Wars fanatic, is look, we have to admit to ourselves that nothing is. We don't get a lot of first experiences.
Right.
The first time you saw Star Wars, you were young, you were impressionable. It was unlike anything you had seen.
It was at Lowe's State in New York. I mean, I remember like lining up and going in there, and you know, just like it was. I mean, because I was in New York doing that play. You know, it was like 77, I think.
It was 77, yeah.
And it was like, man. You know, you just knew that you were in a transformative kind of like, we're going to have Saturday morning cereals. They're back. I never had them. I heard about them. Now we get them, you know, and we get to have that kind of excitement.
Jurassic Park was a very similar experience.
Yeah.
That was another movie that sort of widened the birth of, oh, this is possible now. You can do that now. And it was a different kind of story and a new way to do it, and it was a very very much the same kind of thing. But I don't think the older you get, the less of those shocking new experiences you get.
So they can't. I mean, look, I'm watching Gravity and thinking, my God, I'm living this experience, and I don't care,
right?
Because I've been there, you know. And even though this is done so beautifully well, that. It's not the first time you've had that experience. The thing about Jurassic that made it so exciting was, you know, oh my God, I'm looking at, you know, dinosaurs.
Right.
It's like, it's real. It looks real. I really feel like I'm there. And I think that kind of verisimilitude is not enough anymore. You need something else. You need, for a movie theater experience, you got to go to the next step. What is the next step? Smell-o-vision? Earthquake the movie again with the rumbling seat?
Well, no one's really even perfected 3D yet. So
3D is 3D kind of blows. And people have been trying to make us. But when I was a kid, we had 3D.
Of course.
And it blew then.
it was just a way to get more ticket prices.
And the thing from SCTV. I mean, I remember seeing The Spider in 3D at the Grand Theater in Cartersville, Georgia, and it was on a double bill with The Fly. You know, and then we had one other film where. The guy would burst through the screen. There's a guy on the screen, and he's like, I'm coming to get you. And then then the screen literally would split, and a guy would walk through the screen, go grab a girl from the first row of the audience, and, ah, ah, she'd scream. He'd pick her up, and he would walk back and scream.
God damn it! Why don't they do that? They should do. I feel like the Arclight would do that if anyone would do that.
Why not? Instead of those stupid fucking speeches. Pardon me, but in any case, you know, do we need a curtain speech? No. Grab somebody from the audience. Make my life worthwhile for once. You know, I don't need another 5 minutes of, you know, somebody dressed just like me. Okay, fine.
No.
But
I was telling my. I was telling this guy that. You know, we have to be you have to kind of go into this experience knowing that it's impossible to match that first time you saw it.
Yeah.
So as long as you know that, you can still appreciate it and go, hey, this was great. I want to like it. I want to have a fun experience. I don't want to go in and be cranky about it.
Nor will it diminish your experience that you had.
Of course.
But I mean, look, it's like if you look at Gone with the Wind, you know, and like and this is the first elaborate use of matte paintings, you know, where you're like, it looks like the burning of Atlanta, you right. know what I mean? And it's matte paintings. And you know, so that was technologically in 1939, the equivalent of what happened with Jurassic in 92. But we didn't get that again for a
Holy
long
shit,
time.
That was 92?
92.
Yeah.
Yeah, 22 years ago.
Was it really 92?
Yeah, 92.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
Yeah. 93.
It was 93.
No, it was 93.
It was 93.
It came out in 93?
You were making it.
I shot it in 92. It came
I
out
I thought it was 92 as well.
No, because I remember being 10 years old when it came out.
Well, I thought I was in college.
And I also remember getting kicked out of a movie theater for not being 13. Because it was PG-13.
Oh,
and I snuck in to go see Jurassic.
Well, you're not
Park.
13 now. Would they still?
Oh, now you could be a zygote and see that. This is what goes. Yeah. You know, it's like because I have people come up to me. Like, well, my 2-year-old loves you in Jurassic. I'm like, what? What are you letting a 2-year-old see that for? You know, I mean.
You know, I've seen.
Why does your 2-year-old like this backstabbing computer programmer who's just out for herself?
I know.
I've been to the. I've been to the archives at Skywalker Ranch where they have a lot of original everything, and they have the original matte paintings from Star Wars,
wow.
which are basically done on shower doors. So they got all these shower doors because they're the correct aspect ratio, and they painted. And so it looks like Tatooine, or like when they're with all the stormtroopers, you know, like and they're in the hangar and it's all the stormtroopers and they.
Well, that was a matte.
Yeah, and so they slide them out, and you see. I have pictures of it, and you look at it, and you go, or like the Millennium Falcon,
yeah.
and you look at it, and you go, oh wow, that's a really nice painting. But there's something about the way that it's painted to capture light that when you take a picture of it, and I'm not allowed to post any of the pictures right. that I took there, but. When you look at it as a photograph, it fucking looks real.
Right.
But when you're looking at it in real life, it looks like a beautiful painting. But as soon as you snap a picture, it looks like a real thing. I mean, that kind of artistry, and it is, you know, like Jurassic Park or even just like the original Warner Brothers cartoons when they were spending all the money. It's like, yeah, it's not a surprise that, you know, because you get, what is it? You get quality, time, and money, and you're only ever allowed to have two of
right,
those things.
Right.
So if you spend a lot of money on something and you spend a lot of time on it, you know, then you're going to get, then it's going to come out quality.
But then you go to something like, you know, you never know. Like AI, you know, I mean, same director, same, you know, possibility for it being a monumental, transformative kind of thing. And, you know, you never know.
Some stories resonate with people more than others, I guess.
I don't know. AI supporter. I liked AI a lot.
Yeah, I liked AI.
Yeah, I did. It was like, it was long, but it was, I enjoyed the story of the little boy, the reverse Pinocchio of it all.
I'm trying to think, what did I see recently that was incredibly long? Oh, yes.
Boyhood? Oh, Interstellar.
No, Boyhood was long because it's a person's life. Jesus, come on.
Well, I'm just saying.
Give a break. Jesus
Christ. Was long.
Boyhood
was the longest movie I could think of.
Man, it took him so long to age. He did it in the span of a movie. I think that's pretty good.
Boyhood was quite an achievement, but it was one of those movies, because of the way that it was made, where I was going...
You wanted more?
Well...
I want him to die. This isn't a whole life.
But because there was no traditional act structure, I could not. I was basically in. I felt like I was in a deprivation chamber where I'm like,
when, have you seen the after the before midnight, after midnight, and the 20 minutes after midnight, and midnight once again? It's midnight tomorrow night. All of those films have no act structure.
So you don't know where the halfway point is. So you're like, how long have we been in here? I have no way of knowing.
The only way I could gauge it was having seen Ethan Hawke and the kid in interviews on Good Morning America.
Oh, knowing how old they look now.
That's how old he is. So I'm waiting for that.
It's fascinating, though, the idea of just even pulling that off.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know,
I think that's what is more fascinating in some ways than anything.
But all of his films have like a thing. There's always like some hook of like some meta hook that's not, you know. So that was a good one. That was a good one.
That
took some work.
I didn't see Interstellar yet. Did you enjoy the length of that movie?
You know, like there are times when you can spend a very long time, and it resonates with you in a way that you can remember it moment by moment.
Yeah,
there are times like that.
Not
necessarily this one, but sure. There are times that does happen.
Very polite way of saying that.
I'm just realizing that we've almost kept you for an hour, and I just want to...
And I haven't mentioned The X's, the show that I'm on. For God's sake, why would I come here to talk to you?
Never!
The X is on TV Land on Wednesday night at 10:30, please. Thank you.
Say that again. I was talking over you. I apologize.
The series that I'm doing is The X's, and it's on TV Land. It's at 10:30 on Wednesday nights, and many things happen this year. Something transformative in the life of my character, Haskell, which will make a giant change in him in the second part of the season. Oh, it's exciting.
No spoilers.
Wow.
No spoilers. Did you audition for Seinfeld just going through the regular audition channels, or had they seen you in something and asked you?
No, I came in. The part was, you know, he'd done an episode of Newman voicing it, but they didn't cast an actor. So now they're going to cast Newman, and they have this, and the episode was, you know, the Drake's Cake thing. It's like, well, like, how long do you wait before hitting on the girlfriend of a guy in a coma? was the big question, and so Jerry wants to hit on this, you know, girl whose husband's in a coma, boyfriend's in a coma. I'm a friend of a boyfriend, and I'm the kind of building snitch. Mm-hmm. That was the premise of the character. Like, he was maybe the son of the landlord or something like that. That's how he got an apartment. And he buys me off with the Drake's Cake. And what happened was that I'm sitting there with Michael, and we looked like something out of a 1939 World's Fair. There's like a round thing and a needle, you know, and you're standing side by side, and you go, these two look good together, you know. And I just started coming back, and it just was one of those serendipity things. We thought it was a one-off, and it turned out to be 45 episodes, $1.10. It's an amazing thing. Meanwhile, somebody has $890 million, but not me.
But at some point, I mean, and that, did that just sort of organically, the relationships just organically develop?
It developed, then it devolved, then it transmogrified. I mean, because originally we were working as a two, Michael and I working together, and then one day he says, I don't want to do this anymore. So I went away for a while, and then I came back as Jerry's nemesis.
Right.
So that formulation would not have happened had it not – because Michael's process is very particular. Very different from mine. Mine is more of an improv base, and like wherever you are, find what's there and make funny. And his is basically go in a corner and flagellate yourself for a while, and then
that doesn't sound fun.
And then have Lotsy and moves and things that are all preordained that he knows what he's going to do. He likes to be very secure in what he's doing before he does it, and that's not necessarily a necessity for me.
Was it a fun set?
There were times when it was. I mean, I think the most fun you have as an actor is you sit down at a table and you go, this is a riot. I just don't want to fuck this up. This is really, really good. And then when you do that every time you come, you go, shit. this is good stuff. You know? And I've been on the other side of that. We go, yeah, this stinks.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And so I think that what made that show, if not fun, at least elevated, was that it always felt like a Broadway opening. You know, you each time you did it, you knew that you're making an entrance, you're doing a thing, this is a great joke, let's not blow this joke, let's get the timing right on the joke. If we do the entrance right, and if I do the thing right, and if it goes right, we're going to get the big yuck, you know. And eventually you get the big yuck anyway, just like, as you know, as a comic, you're pre-sold after a certain point. People are laughing regardless,
right,
of whether or not it's funny.
Then he just has to say Newman. And
you, yeah, and then you have to fall back on integrity in your own ear and know when you're getting it right. But still, you want to get it right.
I mean, it is that is a pretty incredible, you know, when you think about, like, oh, that's like when Ralph Kramden would come in, and then Norton would come in, and then everyone would erupt with applause because that was the, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
we had to tell the audience, like, you know, stop applauding, laughing on Kramer entrances. It's blowing the moment.
Oh, wow.
And also, we would shape laughs narrow instead of to their actual dimension. That you'd come and do an entrance and there'd be like, and then you'd see the show and it'd go, because they don't have time for that laugh, you know?
Right.
I mean, there was like 100 pages to these 22-minute shows sometimes. You know, you're in scene double L or something like that. Wow. You know, so they had to keep it rolling. I mean, it was a different kind of idea that you're doing a lot of short scenes and bursts and going, you know, which we don't do the same now, strangely. I mean, it's like they've never really effectively copied the technique of the show.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think it's hard to do. I think because it was a marriage of two philosophies that blended. It's like, you know, you enjoy Reese's peanut butter cups, you know, and you go, well, let's try a liver and a potato chip. You know, it's like, it doesn't work. You know, with Larry and Jerry, you had the observational side and the angst meeting each other. And so there was an observation and then the meaning of the observation and then another observation and then the meaning of that and then how that dovetails into this. And it becomes this cascade of contrapuntal things that's just funny. You know,
right.
I mean, they just were a funny duo in terms of the way it was written.
Well, also that sort of that authenticity nugget of all the stories, you know, growing out of something that happened to one of the writers.
Yeah.
You know, like, this really happened to me. And then they develop it. And all of a sudden it's this sort of weird human experience.
Yeah, well, like I lived across the street from the Soup Nazi on 55th Street. I mean, I actually... You know, Al Yevgeny or whatever, when he, you know, his
soup man.
Yeah, when he, now he's the soup man and yeah. He's selling his stuff. But then it was International Soup Kitchen or whatever, and you would get the little tiny thing of, you know, lobster bisque or something, and maybe bread, maybe not bread, and then that was, you know, what becomes of that thing. Come from me, it's just an observation that, you know, it actually occurred, and there. Other things about Seinfeld, like they were never worried about product placement or getting clearance. They just do it. You know, no, I don't think anybody called Drake's Cakes. I don't think that anybody, they just use whatever product nobody said, we can't say Pez.
Right.
You know, they just did it.
Right.
And like, come get us. And then as the show becomes more and more popular, nobody comes and gets you.
Right. Well, they don't do that now.
No.
You can't, everything has to be cleared. Every mention of every product.
Yeah.
I think that's just cable.
You think so?
I feel like network.
Well, you mean you have that yourself on...
Sure. Yeah. And you're also... You have to be careful...
That's just lawyers, though. That's not real.
Right.
That's a construct that we've all bought into.
Right.
And we accept that they're going to sue. What was the last suit? Show me the documentation of that suit.
I don't know.
You know, it's like...
Yeah, it is.
Armstrong Linoleum in 1971 sued for, you know, okay, all right.
But, well, I, you know, my...
Sued Carol O'Connor.
Yes.
My feeling with all that stuff is that I feel like I try to pick wise battles. So if they go like, well, you can't say this. If I feel like, If I feel like it's absolutely necessary for the thing we're doing, then I'll go, well, we really need it because of this. But if it's not, I'm like, all right, fine. Because it's just not worth arguing with a lawyer all the time. And they're pretty cool to us, but it's still, you know, it's just not worth going to battle every day over stuff that's, you know, mostly insignificant.
Like, what is your standards and practices kind of situation in that context? I mean,
they're really cool to us. I mean, because we're on at midnight, we're, you know, they're pretty loose. They're pretty loose with us.
Do you find that as you become more popular, they've gotten looser?
We started off pretty loose. You know, what I find now is that I'm almost kind of, I think it might behoove us to self-police a little bit because, you know, left to our own devices.
Scary.
Left to our own devices, it's just like, oh, it's dick jokes and fuck this and fuck that. And,
right.
You know, I mean, at a certain point, it just starts to get messy and muddy with all that.
Well, it takes the place of craft.
It does. Yeah. It's basically a smoke and mirrors, and it's and a lot of times.
And it's tough too when you're writing about the same sort of stuff. You get the same, like this, you're making jokes about the same things, and you're having to find different angles to take to have a point of view for the show and for Chris to take, and it gets to be like a little.
But I also know
it's a lot of acrobatics sometimes.
But I also know that with my stand up, I know that when I throw fuck into something, then if it's not absolutely necessary for that piece, I know that it's me being insecure about the integrity,
right.
Like about the
suddenly I'm Uncle Dirty.
Yeah, exactly. it's basically me saying like, oh, I'm not as confident with this joke, and so I do that to, you know, and so it's something that I think, but they're, you know, they're pretty cool with us, and we get away with, I think. I mean, I can't think of many other shows that get away with the amount of stuff we get away with and the things that we say. And it's only – and there are very specific things that just aren't worth fighting for where they're like, well, you can't mention a specific porn site.
Or we have to bleep cum.
You have to bleep – you have to bleep.
Go ahead.
Bleep cum.
Yeah.
What about jizz? Would that work?
Jizz you can say. A lot of cum bleeping though.
Yeah.
A lot of cum bleeping.
And if we write out jizz on, if you see it on the screen, we have to star out.
You can't put jizz on the teleprompter.
You can't read. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
but you know,
can we say spunk?
Sure can, buddy.
Spooge.
Yeah. Spooge. Man cream. Man cream's totally fine.
Man cream actually is a great title for a book or a Chicago.
Wayne Knight's man cream.
A Chicago-based DJ.
Man cream.
You just made a man cow reference. That's amazing. Did you ever live in Chicago?
No.
Oh, that's really funny. That's really funny. I didn't either, but I just from doing.
I did a man cow, and you know, I mean, I was in Alaska or something.
Yeah. You must have done it.
And I was frightened because you know they warn you, you know, be careful going in. It's like I guess going into Stern or something like that. You know, they're like careful. They're nasty in there. You know, like whatever.
Well, I think, but my impression of being on Stern, I called into Stern once years ago, but I've never actually been in studio. My impression is that they're probably actually really cool. They know how the show runs.
They're pretty.
Like it's all, you know, I think there are some morning guys around the country though that where you're like, oh yeah, that guy's barely hanging on by a thread.
And they're going to attack you because there's nothing better to do.
There's nothing better to do, and you know also the monotony of having to get up at 3:30 every morning does take a toll on your psyche. After a while.
Well, now, how do you, or like, I'll to be on the other side of the couch.
Please.
You know, you've kind of created this multi-headed hydra of...
Hail Hydra.
Yeah, you know, popular person who. Well, how do you describe yourself now? I mean, what are you?
I don't know. When people say, if someone doesn't know me and they go, what do? I go, I'm a comedian. You know, like I'm a stand-up, which is what I am. That's what I was. That's what I always wanted to be. That's what I was. That's how I perceive myself, even though I haven't been writing as much lately, but a lot of stuff that I do, most of the things that I do were designed to put my voice into the world so people could decide if they wanted to come see me live.
And would you take a break and go back out?
I do. I just do it. I sandwich it in. I'm starting a tour. I'm doing 5 dates in San Francisco in a couple weeks, and then in January, when Talking Dead's not shooting, I'm going out and doing 16 weekends. So I just smush it in, and then it's, you know, 2 cities a weekend. So I just do it because it's
just living Jay Leno's old life.
Well, the animal
without the cars.
The animal is Louis C.K., who would, that guy could be in prison and he'd figure out a way to sneak out and do sets. Like he would. I'm not so crazy. Like I did a set last night in L.A., but I won't do that five nights a week. In New York, you know, Louis would be riding on Conan, and he'd, when he wasn't supposed to, sneak out, do a set, and then get back. You know, like he's just
so. You think he felt it was restorative to him, so that he could write?
I feel like he. Well, my guess, knowing what I know of Louis, he probably felt like you cannot call yourself a stand-up unless you're doing stand-up every night of the week. And also, he, I think, knew that it was good for his craft, and I think also it's the kind of thing where people go like, well, I don't know how you do stand-up. And it's like, well, I don't know if it's a choice. It's like it's just something that you're compelled to do for whatever broken reason you have. And so I think that's part of what it is. So when people ask me, I say, oh, I'm a stand-up and I started this thing and we make stuff. Like I don't know how to describe it. I make stuff and I get to host shows and I do stand-up.
But see, you know, there's a certain degree of envy that I have for stand-ups in one sense, in that you start out as an entertainer, that you're not an actor, you're an entertainer who.
Sure.
So you can do almost anything and you don't besmirch yourself by doing it. You know, if you want to do a game show, you can.
Sure.
If you want to do this, you can. If you want to host this, you can. You can do whatever you want. As an actor, you're like, well, I don't know. As an actor, if I can do that, it would really be,
Sure.
And I'm not sure if that's true or not, or if it's just like something that actors tell themselves
to
keep them out of work.
I don't think that's as true anymore as it used to be. I mean, you know, Jane Lynch hosts Hollywood Game Night. She's an actor. Like, it's not. There's so much crossover now. I think 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, it was like, you're a host, you're a comedian, you're a movie person, you're a sitcom actor, you're a dramatic actor.
I think the movie person thing is the hardest one to blend with the other things.
Sure.
I mean, that staying in that while doing the others is harder in America than it is in, say, Britain. You know, in Britain, you can do a Christmas pantomime, do a chat show, do a quiz show.
Everyone does everything.
Yeah, because it's a smaller pool, and so nobody judges you for any of that.
I don't think there's as much judgment as you might think, and I certainly don't think there's as much judgment now, but I understand what you're saying, where stand-up, the base of it is almost more of a Swiss Army knife of like, you know, but I also think that I think it actually stand-ups don't get cast as just actors.
They get cast as themselves or as a funny guy.
Because there are definitely not all stand-ups are great. I mean, a lot of times you see the
Paul Reiser. How did he pull that off?
Well, because that was kind of the Seinfeld. Like that came out.
No,
of
but I mean, when he was doing like Aliens and stuff. Like, how do you pull that off? I don't understand that.
I think he might have been.
How'd Belzer get the police gig? How'd that happen?
Because someone was probably a fan of Belzer's, but with Paul Reiser, my assumption is that he was a New York actor guy that also did stand up. I think there were a couple that, but. You know, you usually see the crossroads when early on in someone's comedy development, are they a sketch person or are they a stand-up person?
Right.
And sketch people tend to not like to be themselves on stage, and stand-ups tend to not like to be other people on stage.
Right.
So I think a lot of it depends on where you like your creative responsibility to lie. Personally, I like to be responsible for everything I say, not as a character. Because I always just feel like, well, you know, it's me. All right, it's
but I
me.
Think that's astute, and I think that's why Chris Rock didn't do as well on SNL as he could have.
Boy, that was such a, you know, for people who don't really understand, you know, when you think we go Chris Rock, of course, is in the pantheon, like he's in the Mount Rushmore of comedians.
Right.
But he did flail quite a bit on SNL.
Yeah.
And which made Bring the Pain a couple years after SNL such an explosive, like, holy fuck, where was that guy, you know? And just sort of realizing, oh, not every form of comedy suits every performer.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I think some people like to be themselves and other people are like someone is a great character person, but you sit them down and talk to them one-on-one or you put them up on stage where they have to present an award or be themselves and they just don't know who – they're not comfortable.
I'm very interested to see what's going to happen with James Corden.
Oh yeah,
that to me is an interesting experiment.
I think he'll be good. I mean,
I've seen him be riotously funny.
Yeah.
In texted material, you know, I don't know.
How's it going to be? Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a good, you know, it's a risk. We'll see what happens. But I'm rooting for him because I think he's, you know, I saw him on stage in New York, and I used to watch him in British stuff and whatever, hosting with his former partner or whatever, and I think he's a funny guy.
Well, I think we can never underestimate the power of a smirk and some wry British charm. Like, the accent, you know, the accent alone, people are like, oh, say more, you know, and then the fact that he's funny, you know, I think it'll probably work. I mean, it's tough. Late night is such a weird, you know, if we were...
You've discovered, I mean... whether you crafted it or it happened, the tone for late night is very significant of how to have an irreverent playfulness that allows you to go anywhere you want to go. That, you know, I mean, that as an audience member, you want to come to a show and feel like, oh, I might go somewhere I don't expect.
Sure.
And that is part of the late night feeling.
It's hard, though. I mean, like, just because audiences are so splintered – late night shows, you know, I mean, morning and late night are challenging because you're basically trying to break into someone's ritual.
Right.
You know? And so it's not, it's like, what do I do before I go to bed or what do I do first thing when I get up in the morning? And I feel like morning shows, morning radio, late night shows are difficult because
very intimate.
You have to sort of earn your place into someone's, like, this is what I do every night before I go to bed. This is because those are the times where people like to feel the most familiar with their programming.
So do you feel like it has to be codified into a kind of a, like, we can't change this too much because if we do, we're going
to
blow.
No, I feel like it's at a point where they should try to change it. And I think any success that At Midnight had was because it was different. You know, it was a different way to present material. And so when I see a new late night panel show, and it's like, no, don't do the monologue. You don't have to do it. You know, like, right. I know everyone else does a monologue there. Do fucking mix it up. You know, like, people can see monologues. I mean, ultimately, it does boil down to the strength of the point of view of the person presenting the material. And if they have a strong enough point of view, that's ultimately what people will gravitate toward. You know, people love Ferguson's approach because he tore up the cards and he spoke like a person and he sort of broke the format.
And he actually spoke to people.
He talked to people.
Which was frightening to people.
And so, you know, that was his thing. And but it's very difficult to, you know, like, you know, I'm British, but here I am, another white guy in this late night lineup of white dudes. How is my take going to be different than their, you know? So I don't know. I don't know.
It's very interesting to see somebody, you know, I mean, as the idea of walking away from these things.
Sure.
Is very interesting.
Yeah.
I always find that.
I think you know, I think it does. Our show's really easy for me to do every day because the structure is ultimately similar to the night before and the content's refillable and the comics are different. But having to do, like, I am genuinely, and we sort of play with Fallon in terms of, like, oh, he's basically doing slime time, you know, every night, like a karaoke. But to basically do that type of variety show every day, I don't know how that doesn't melt your fucking brain.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know,
so much effort.
So much effort. So many games and so much, like, singing and dancing.
And you've
so
got
much
to participate in all of that.
Yes,
jazz.
Yes. And you have to not only be engaged in your guest, whatever the fuck that is that they're
and
trying to
force run, them to do it.
Force them to do it. And then also carry the, if they're, you know, because not everyone's a great guest. And, you know, like, it's a, that type of late night show feels like it would drive you kind of crazy.
Yeah, but then, you know, what I'd like to do is just cut to 5 years from now.
Right.
And see what that show is like.
Yeah, who knows?
I don't know how you do it.
It's,
you know,
even super sloppier celebrity double dare.
But, you know, because when you look at the Carson show, I look at the original Tonight Show back in the 60s, then into the 70s, and then what happens as you age and go, ah, fuck it, I don't want
right.
to. I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that Ann Blabby shit anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. And Letterman, too, as he, you know, these different things that he did while young and that you just...
You get tired.
You get tired.
Well, and also I think the older you get, I mean, when you're younger,
you're super hungry for that thing you want, whether it's, you know, notoriety or the audience's approval, or I got to be the funniest, I got to do. And I think as people get older, it's like, I don't give a shit. You know, like the when they genuinely as people don't fucking care anymore, I think that's where it, that's where the comedy part dips, because you need a little bit
That's when Al Roker started getting good. Like, but fuck the weather. You know, but, that's all we're talking about.
But even, you know, like you look at, like, you know, Joan Rivers until the day that she died, which sucked a lot.
Yeah, God almighty.
It was still like every day was super hungry. Even
I mean, look, you know, writing jokes about people she didn't even know who they were 5 minutes ago.
Right.
You know, you're like, what does she do? And then you write a joke about it. And it is pretty amazing.
I think that hunger and that curiosity and that drive to, you know, and we've had a few people on the show who are older who have that. And you're like, oh, that's why you still, you know, are excited and make stuff. But then, you know, I think that's what can happen with comics is that you need that fire. You know, you need that fire to you know, that makes you leave your job and go do a set and come back to your job or tour when you don't really have the time because you know, the older you're like, I don't, how much more money do I need? How much, I don't need attention. I've got it. I have enough. You know, people just get tired. I think they just get tired.
No, so in other words, you think this is an outgrowth of stand-up for real? I mean, not just like you do stand-up and then to get you to this stuff. This is stand-up. It's just another form of...
You mean like podcasting and everything?
I mean all of it. I mean the idea that what you're still observing about things.
Sure, yeah.
And so you got shit to say that you don't even know you've got to say.
Sure.
And it keeps you from backing up.
Yeah, it's all part of the same. I mean, the different mediums express it differently, and the responses are different in different ways. But ultimately, it's the same mechanism, you know? It's the same. It's just like, well, on this show, the jokes come out through this structure. And in stand-up, they come out this way. And in this podcast format, this is how they come out. And they're all different but complementary.
Our last serious question, and
yes.
I'll leave you.
All right.
So in terms of stand-up, where you're crafting and mm-hmm. you're, you know, in Seinfeld's lexicon of how you craft words and pauses and commas and, you know, over and over and again until you get it just right and just right and just right. So you're crafting jokes that play for you gangbusters one night, not the next, and you learn, okay, then I don't do this and I do that. Then you're in this, which is very disposable. Mm-hmm. What's coming out of your mouth leaves and you leave.
Right.
And that happens on a daily basis.
Sure.
So does that infect your stand-up?
Infect it in
a negative way.
No, I haven't found it to. As a matter of fact, I think the more other work I've done, especially with podcasts, has made me more comfortable and has actually helped me get to understand myself better, which has helped me with stand-up. Because now my
like what your point of view is.
My point of view is now a lot more personal than it used to be, because I used to just write about other things, and now I kind of have a better understanding of myself, so I'm sort of writing more about.
Oh, you actually believe you're interesting. I see. Now you're using your point of view.
I'm trying to convince people if I can trick them into thinking that. But, you know, it's learning how to get to a point, you know, and understand through talking really fast how to come at that in a bunch of different ways has actually really helped stand-up, because I understand my rhythms more now.
Right.
So I'm more likely now on stage to get laughs if I'm just describing something the way I naturally would, as opposed to 5 or 8 years ago or 10 years ago, where I would have been like, how do I make this thing funny? Like, now I feel like there's more of a – I understand the mechanisms just a little bit evolved than it used to be. Like Louis, I opened for him – oh, probably in 2007 in Phoenix, Tempe. And he went up on stage and for the first – basically did like 20 minutes of material that I hadn't heard in the previous shows. And afterwards he was like, yeah, I just riffed the first 20 minutes. I just want to see how far I could take it. And it all sounded like written stand-up, because his machine was becoming so refined that just the way that he was expressing ideas on stage just sounded like stand-up. And it the jokes basically just fell into line as he was talking, even though he didn't really know what was going to come out of his mouth next. Because that was, I mean, like, that's, you know, when you can really become like a hay baler where it's just like shunk, 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 and then like that's, I think that's a good place to strive.
What if
for.
More Amsterdam were actually funny?
Hey, what are you talking about? That's, what are you guys?
Who else used to walk through, you know, walk through a house and like, give me any topic.
Any topic. What do you want? Anything. What do you think?
So, yeah. So, I don't know. And maybe, who knows? Maybe you'll try the stand-up at some point.
You know, people have tried. I mean, I've had people recently say, you know, it's time. You should force yourself to live a life or die.
Right.
You know, because I think that that's what I get when I talk to stand-ups. It's like, you know, don't be afraid of it because bombing is part of it.
Of
this
course.
Is what you do in order to, you know, it's like playing guitar. If you can't get through the callous period, you're never going to play.
Well, and the, and when you're in a play or you're in a sketch, if something bombs, you're stuck in that construct.
Right.
But when you're doing stand-up, you can make a quick left or right turn or you can talk to someone and they, like, you're free. I find it to be way more freeing than stuck in something that you're like, well, they didn't like the first 10 minutes of this, but there's 80 more minutes, you know?
Right.
So of whatever this play or whatever this sketch show is. So I think it's to me, it feels less risky from that point.
Well, I've had that, you know, conversation where sometimes somebody feels more secure in an arena
right.
than they do in a room.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm that way, too. Like, I can get weird when there's just a couple people in a room where it's like, I don't know how to I don't know what to say, you know. But podcasting has actually made me more comfortable just because now I can talk to pretty much anybody and I feel okay. And I was not that way before.
And, you know, I don't get the sense that you are broadcasting. I get the sense that we're having a conversation and you're broadcasting.
Yeah. Well, we lure you into that false sense.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but that's the idea of when it works, one would hope. That, you know, you are having a conversation that is heightened because you're trying to make it interesting.
Well, but I think there's also, you know, I think you have this idea when you're a young performer of like, well, I'm me, and this is the performance me, and they're separate,
right,
and I have to be presentational. And I think the better you get, the closer those two things become until ultimately you're just yourself. Because it's very hard to think of yourself as the thing that is working. Like, no, it's not. I'm not.
Tell
I'm not
that interested. To Marcel Marceau, my friend. I don't think it worked for him.
Come on.
Pulling that rope, that guy. I don't know.
Now dig up Shields and Yarnell. They're dead, right?
What a reference.
Hey.
What a pull. Listen, oh, my God. I would have thought that was outside your demographic.
The only mime I was ever hot for.
You spend a year and a half in a writer's room with Blaine Kapach.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Blaine. Yeah, Blaine, you'll get enough Shields and Yarnell. Today we got a Hardcastle and McCormick reference.
Holy mackerel.
I know. He was really digging deep. But... But The X's is on.
The X's is on Wednesday nights after Hot in Cleveland, which is in its farewell tour this season.
I was shocked to hear how many episodes of that show had been done. It was an exorbitant amount of episodes for Hot in Cleveland.
They were pumping them, I'm telling you.
Betty White, they just like, what a workhorse.
Well, you know, a workhorse in more ways than you know, because I know her agent very well, Jeff Witches, and he rides her back several times a day.
Yeah.
And she's like, come on, you old. Come on. You know, she's like, please, I'd like to stop.
I know, Jeff. Tell Jeff I said hi. This was a great chat with you. Are you on social media anywhere that people can poke at you?
I'm on Twitter, but I barely respond. That's not true. I will respond, but in my own way.
In your own
by
way.
By just speaking in generic terms about things I'm doing. So,
And on the other hand, Wayne is getting background information on you, and
yes.
Wayne Knight Rider will be in theaters Christmas of 2016.
Yes.
If I say that, it might. Then maybe we'll manifest.
Tiddling, yes.
Good to see you, man.
Thanks.
Enjoy your beer, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.